Hello, Joel here. I've got a new book out. It's called Be Funny or Die: How Comedy Works and Why It Matters. And it's about how comedy works and why it matters. Why human beings tell jokes, and then what that tells us about being human beings. So if you're a human being and you enjoy laughing and then want to know what the hell's going on with that, it's probably a pretty good book to read. It's called Be Funny or Die. It's in shops. You can buy it.
Here's a cool fact. A crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Another cool fact, you can get short-term health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans are designed for people who are between jobs, coming off their parents' plan, or turning a side hustle into a full-time gig. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. Get more cool facts about UnitedHealthcare short-term plans at uh1.com.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hello and welcome to Rule of Three, a podcast about comedy. I'm Jason Hazley.
And I'm Joel Morris.
And as usual, we're joined by someone who makes comedy to talk about something funny that they love. By taking it apart, maybe we'll learn something about how comedy works, or we'll just quote bits from it and giggle until we're finished. Both approaches are valid. Our special guest today is the award-winning writer and performer John Finnemore. John, hello.
Hello. Hello.
You've just finished series 55 of Souvenir Programme, haven't
yes,
you?
Yes, me and my team of 600 writers and intelligent primates, yes.
Yes, yes. And your last episode of that has been nominated for a Pulitzer Prize for Recursion, hasn't it?
Yeah, well, we'll see what, you know, the Nobel Committee are dragging their feet, but now that...
That was an absolutely extraordinary episode. I mean, it was a real tour de force. I think I sent you an email saying you're basically Jimi Hendrix, aren't you?
Yeah, which I was delighted about, because no one has ever in the past, nor will ever again in the future, compared me to Jimi Hendrix, but it's now happened once.
It's your psychedelic stylings and enormous hair.
Absolutely.
Your producer and our friend Ed Morrish at some point told me precisely how many sketches you had single-handedly written for Souvenir Programme, and it slightly frightened me, because I think it's more than Joel and I will ever write in our lifetimes, and there are two of us.
Well, it's also that the sketch shows usually have a team of people. That's how you do a sketch show, because they're hungry beasts. They eat material really fast, and the usual logic is that will exhaust the finest minds in Britain. And it hasn't exhausted this finest mind. It's amazing.
Well, it's just, it's probably the same number of man hours, or maybe a few more. It's just I do all the man hours, and so I start writing it much earlier, and I do tryouts, and I, you know, spend a lot of time on writing it. In the same way I might spend that amount of time writing 10 sketches for 10 different shows, or 10 different people might write 10 sketches for me.
So it's just admin. You've taken all the glamour out of it.
I love. Well, I don't love doing it. I don't love writing at all. But I really enjoy being able to do what I like with it, and being able to, and it allows me, I think, to do sketches in different. Well, I can try to make sketches as different as possible, knowing that the fact that I'm writing it all will, you know, despite my best efforts, in a way, make it cohere. So I can do big, silly ones with talking animals, and I can do, you know, polemical ones about stuff that makes me angry. I can do parodies. I can do little character monologue pieces. If you had a writer's room like we've both been in often together, think of you as a sort of two-headed beast. Well, then if you allow people to do whatever, then you get something that's so diverse that it doesn't feel like anything. It doesn't feel like any one beast. So you have to, if you're going to have a writer's room, you have to say, either have a showrunner or say, these are the rules, everything's a parody or nothing's a parody. Or I suppose it allows me to do a more... old-fashioned sketch show with no particular theme, just sort of sketch blackout, because the theme is I wrote it all.
The linking theme for your show is that it's your brain and your voice, which I suppose is what's making people buy into the world.
You know, I don't have a stable of characters I bring out every week. It is just, here are the 12 best things that we that Ed and I decided were worthy of going in this episode.
So the theme is goodness. Yeah. Just good ones. Just good ones. You don't do the bad ones.
Oh. Well, I write the bad ones, obviously.
It takes ages to write the bad ones.
Oh, I know.
If only you could just skip.
That's an inefficiency.
And you can't even when something's looking bad as you write it, you can't go, oh, well, I'm writing a bad one, I can skip that. Because as we know, sometimes the bad one turns into a good one later on when you realise something about it.
That legendary thing that, is it David Renwick who wrote the Mastermind sketch?
Yeah.
Answering the previous question. And he'd thrown that in the bin. He had to take it out of the bin and sellotape it back
together.
I
think he'd literally torn it up because he tried to write a clever sketch. I think he wanted to write a sort of Palin Jones sketch because they were, you know, young and funny. And he thought, oh, well, I could do that. I'll write a clever sketch. And then he wrote this. Oh, this is ridiculous. Sort of, no one, there's no laughs in this. It's just a crossword puzzle, and ripped it up, threw it away.
Good evening. Your name, please.
Good evening.
You have chosen to answer the question before last each time. Is that correct?
Charlie Smithers.
And, I mean, it's terrific. It's,
but you don't know as the writer how it's going to play for an audience. And the audience can't see the hard work that's gone into it and can't see the scaffolding.
No, sometimes you... I would say you know to within a degree, because I try out my stuff for the sketch show. We do little tryouts for an audience of about 70, and I try and do as many as there will be recording, so about 5 or 6. And I write lots more material than we need, and some of it doesn't... Some of it only goes out in the preview, and then some that gets rewritten, and then we record too much as well, and not all of that goes into the edit. It's about 72 sketches for a series, and I probably write 10 or so more. Well, I probably write 20 or so more than that, but we leave 8 to 10 out in the edit as well. So that's probably what Ed was thinking about with the big number, because that's, 72 issues plus the ones that didn't make it. Plus all of those years in Salt Mines with writing sketches for Dead Ringers and for Mitchell and Webb. And
yeah.
I say Salt Mines. Lovely fellows, lovely times. But
yeah, lovely salt.
Everyone loves salt.
Have you written things which have absolutely tanked in tryout?
I've had stuff that just nobody got, including the cast, and people sort of titter along, and then I realise, oh right, that reference just doesn't work at all. You don't know what I mean. I tried to do one about the before clickbait was a widely known thing, but when it was just sort of starting to happen and all those little adverts, I tried to do one about, you know, local mum invents this trick, dermatologists hate her. I'd seen a lot of that advert because obviously I'm always frantically googling for skincare products, as you can tell. So naturally
you're like an orb.
Oh, I'm a big pink orb. Yeah, no, I'm as glossy as a seal, and and for that reason I was seeing a lot of this advert, and clearly it hadn't really percolated through, and so for everyone else this was just a totally baffling sort of jam style sketch in which a thing happens without an explanation. The cast really liked it, although none of them got it.
So the thing you brought us to talk
is my
about
own show,
today,
yes.
But is thematically not miles off. We're talking here about what is it, in the industry is called broken comedy, because no one commissions sketch shows anymore, so they started calling them broken comedy. But sketch shows, but a sketch show with a voice, a sketch show that has its own world, and I imagine is one that influenced you or that you loved.
Yeah, strictly speaking, the day-to-day was the first thing I discovered for myself that was my own. You know, there was lots of comedy that I enjoyed before that, but it had either been my parents introducing it to me or people at school saying, oh, you got to watch Blackadder, it's amazing. But then this was the first, day-to-day was the first thing that I literally, like, watched the first one of as it went out and went, oh, wow, I really, truly love this. And also, it's mine and I found it. And then I'm not talking about that today, I'm talking about On the Hour, which was the radio version that preceded it, although I came to it later, but pretty much at the same time.
Yes, it was the same order for me as well. I think we were living together when the Day Show first went out in 94, didn't we?
Oh, God, I remember videoing it and wearing the video out in the first week. I found my diary from that year, and it just says on each day, watch the Day Today again. Watch the Day Today twice today. Took it around someone else's house. It was like this viral thing that...
I didn't do that. I wasn't confident enough to go and tell other people and say, oh, this is my comedy taste, watch this, but so I hoarded it to myself.
It, like On the Hour, rewards repeat visits, doesn't it? I mean, it is so gloriously funny, and you just can't move for gags. They are everywhere.
Yeah. And again, although it's got such a... Because just in case it's new to anyone, it's a new show. It's a parody of news shows and also magazine shows, but then it sort of broadens out into parodies of all kinds of little Radio 4 shows by saying, oh, well, here's a preview of, you know, a travel programme or whatever.
But first, the news. The Bank of England has lost the pound, plunging the financial world into turmoil this afternoon. Smarting officials say a search has been mounted and there is no need to panic.
It was a way of doing a parody show that was incredibly thorough and real. And the people who came out of it then went on to spread their worldview, because it's Armando Iannucci and Chris Morris as sort of the chief engines behind it. But it also features... it's the birth of Alan Partridge, and Steve Coogan's on the cast. It's got voices within it. Lee and Herring are writing for it.
But voices Rebecca within Front's it. In it, Dean McKeegan's in it.
It's people who there's went on to great
David Schneider, things. I mean, there's almost no one who didn't, which is remarkable as well. There's on cast or crew, and writers, there's nobody who's not working in comedy today and mostly kind of leading the industry in comedy today. It's extraordinary. The thing, when I went back and looked at it, I suppose this was inevitable, but the cast photo that came up, you got, they're so young!
They're about nine, aren't they?
Now, I know that's, you know, as we get older, that happens with everything. You look at Monty Python and go, oh, they're so young. But the thing about On the Hour is that it looks... sounds rather so, you know, so polished. They've grown up. It's very complex in the editing and all the sound engineering and all the ridiculous things they do to parody, and then sometimes parody and sometimes just be silly with this world. It makes it sound like a much more accomplished. You look at them and think they can't possibly have done that. They're children.
What's amazing about it, I think, and why probably I had the same reaction as you as I was looking at photos, cast photos, and going, they're so young, is that I was younger than them, obviously, when the show came out. And I looked to them and went, oh, you're my big brothers, all the grown-ups, and you've worked out how the world works. You're like a cool cousin who's going to go, hey, you know how politics works?
Yeah.
And they've taken the back off the clock. And what fascinated me about it is, because it is just silly, it is nonsense in a shape, is that the people behind it, if you look at Iannucci and Morris, they come from a production background. So they're fascinated not with what's in the news, or what's in the content of radio, but what it sounds like and how it's made.
Mathematicians have announced the existence of a new whole number, which lies between 27 and 28. We don't know why it's there or what it does, said Cambridge mathematician Dr. Hilliard Halliard. We only know that it doesn't behave properly when put into equations, and that it is divisible by 6, though only once. Here's our science correspondent, Nick Watkins. I'm sorry, we don't appear to...
Minimum wage!
And they're constantly showing you the producer and the tapes. This is how the media works. And afterwards you go, all right, so now I know how the media works. The grown-ups have shown me, so now I won't trust it as well. And it is like a sort of slightly jaded... manager at a shop showing you round the back how they make the stuff.
Yeah.
And I think that's what made me suck it up, because it wasn't just Roy Hattersley is fat. It was the news wants you to think Roy Hattersley is fat.
Yes, they actually do Weekending at one point, don't they, which was the big satire show at the time.
Yeah.
And they a room they many of them, certainly Lee and Herring, I think, or Herring, would have been in, of just like jaded satirist going, well, I thought maybe John Major, we could take it back to Robin Hood times, and with John Major as Robin Hood and Gorbachev very much Sheriff of Nottingham. I thought that's interesting things we could get out of that. And wow, that really is biting the hand not only that feeds you, but the hand of your, you know, kind of next door neighbour. Yeah. You know, we don't tend to poke fun at other comedy shows, do we, when we write sketches for people?
I think
people.
Armando had produced Weekending, hadn't he?
Yes, I think he had.
I'm pretty sure he had.
Yeah. Everyone involved has been behind the scenes making news, and they've all had news training. I mean, Chris Morris had done the BBC News course,
yeah,
so he knew how it was made. And there's a brilliant line in it, which I always love this stuff, where you feel, oh, the grown-ups are showing me something. And there's a great line where he says something like, and now we're going over to so-and-so and so-and-so, and it's a blue tape, so we know it's from the US. And right, that's a joke just for the BBC production team. But I went, all right, because we all know that the news desk, if it's a blue cartridge, that's a... And they're letting you see
right
behind the scenes of the news you've accepted as a facade.
Yeah.
as this monolithic voice, and they're going, you know, it's just people who make it.
Yes, while simultaneously really exaggerating that monolithic voice, the sort of the main Chris Morris voice he does. Although listening back to it, I've forgotten just how much Chris Morris is in it.
Yeah.
I thought it was Chris Morris presents it and then everyone else plays everyone else, but actually Chris Morris presents it and plays about half of the everyone else's.
I had exactly the same reaction. I thought this, it feels like the cast in it, in other words, Coogan, Schneider, Front, McKeon, all those people, they feel like they're the second unit because so much of it is just Chris and then throwing to Chris doing another voice and then throwing to Chris doing another voice.
And then maybe Chris interviewing a member of public or something. But and then there'll be a colour supplement and he won't be in it and it'll be Patrick Marber, who is the one we haven't mentioned yet, interviewing the others doing silly voices. And it, so it really does feel like a support act, a bit like, you know, Punt and Dennis popping up on Just for Carrot.
Yeah. it's got this odd thing of there being two units working. One's maybe is Armando's unit, which is cast like a radio show. And then there's Chris Morris's unit, which is him sped up, slowed down, doing impressions, silly sound effects, more like a Kenny Everett, Vivian Stanchel, cut up. Like a radio DJ would make a show, and they've been stuck together. But again, we make a return to, this is broken comedy, this is a sketch show that's got a single voice.
And also, they do something which I wouldn't have thought worked at all, and I wouldn't have done this, even in his bits. There are various ways he goes with it. Sometimes he interviews Patrick Marber playing a reporter, and sometimes it's a cut-up of Douglas Hurd answering his questions, you know, answering the wrong questions to make them stupid. Sometimes it's a member of the public or a junior, you know, a genuine, some poor woman from the RSPCA who he does a prank call on, sometimes as a member of the public. So you don't know until you're kind of 30, so you have to work out into your 30 seconds into the piece, well, which one is he doing now? Is this a real stand passerby, or is this, I think I can hear David Schneider's voice, I think. And sometimes you don't even know by the end of it. And you think, well, that, I wouldn't have thought that would work. I would have thought, no, you want to know what the joke is. Otherwise,
what's the rules?
If this isn't a real person, then it's not as funny as if it is, or vice versa. But you know, they pull it off.
But I remember Chris saying something about how he did his cut-ups and things. And he said, it's not funny unless the audience know it's fake.
Yeah.
And what he's trying to do is stay maybe a step ahead of you in guessing how it's been faked. But there's no point in any of the cut-ups where he's attempting to do what would now be called, not even fake news, but like the parody news sites now try and pass their news off as real news, and they're delighted when someone picks up on it.
Oh, right.
No. And there's no sense that he wants to trick you into thinking that that really is Douglas Hurd, because he'll go across to it and say the Queen said something and it'll be a man's voice, or it'll be, you can hear the futs and the pops in the edits.
There's the Queen. I mean, some of the best cut-ups, I think, are when it's just one line and it just, so it's the Queen. The Queen has beaten her sister in a drinking contest, and then cuts to the Queen saying, as I stand here today, I am conscious.
They're constantly letting you in on how it's a magician. It feels like Penn and Teller, that sort of, like, they're doing a magic trick to show you how the media works. And the easiest way is to keep pulling the sides off the boxes and saying,
right,
this is just cut up. If you wanted to make a news story, this was how you'd edit it. And it's showing you the artifice of news. And I love that about it, because it's not, you can listen to it now, and unlike most ostensible satire or shows, you don't actually know what was going on in the news at the time.
No,
because it's
true,
just about news. It's not about the news. It's about news as a thing.
This is On the Hour. Arise, Sir News.
But also, it's full of jokes. It's full of stupid, just stupid wordplay and, you know, ridiculous one-liner news stories.
God, it's got some of the best silly names I've ever heard in it.
Oh, my God.
There was, what was the one that I nearly crashed the car listening to it the weekend when Peter Sisters Christmas came up?
Yes. Hippolyta Loud Basket.
Yeah, and there's people like Gavin Shape.
Yes.
And there's at one point, there's someone called Conan Batters Christ.
It's got something which we talked about ages ago as a thing that we like to do, and I think we probably got it from On the Hour and the Day Today and other people, which is you're looking at a newspaper or the news or listening to the news and you defocus.
Yeah.
You're not paying attention. It's like when you're doing the washing up and the news is on. When we used to do the Framley Examiner, which was a spoof local newspaper, we would actually just look at local newspapers and defocus until the headlines swam in front of us.
Yeah.
And it had the feeling and the rhythm and the shape of news, but you pour gibberish into it. And they've got lots of areas they do it with, names and headlines. And because if you defocus, it sounds like real news, but it isn't. And again, we talk about this a lot. The bucket that's containing the gibberish is absolutely secure.
Yeah.
And there's no point, there's no leaks in the bucket. The bucket is tight. And you can pour porridge and spanners and old hammers into it, and it'll still be a bucket.
That fascination with how, basically, this sounds like radio, apparently, but actually it's not making any sense, is a thing that you've hooked onto, isn't it, with in a souvenir programme where you do things like how radio sounds if you're not really paying attention, or recently the beautiful one you did in that last episode, the last series, about how the weather sounds, even if you've tuned in especially and are trying to concentrate on
it. That way that you... I find it impossible anyway. By the time they've got through the bit where they... I can listen for the bit where they tell me about what the weather's been like.
I know, isn't that bizarre?
Which I don't know why they do.
In the east, west and south upstairs, we can expect a high horse on the landing in the late 30s. And that'll be jostled by a rude head waiter of 54 or 55 towards the mid-morning. Back to front, it'll be a fried egg for most of the country. With a butcher's dog unfurling a wicker hammock later, expecting twins, before dropping down and giving me 20.
I
think that's from a good tradition. That comes to me, in my mind, that goes, well, that's the rhythm of Vivian Stanshall, which is a huge influence on Chris Morris and Amanda Iannucci, and the rhythm of John Lennon. Okay. Lennon's poetry is all that. It's just gibberish in the shape of sense, which he would have got from Milligan, probably, or Bob. And Edward Lear. Oh, Jabberwocky is that. Jabberwocky is the shape of sense.
Yeah.
With the sense emptied out. As long as you hit the right number of posts along the way, you don't get lost in the sentence.
And as you say, the more that there is a bucket that you're pushing against, the Jabberwocky is in the shape of a epic poem. And this is a perfect example of that, where you've got something really constrained that you are... then talking nonsense in the headlines section at the beginning, where they just do four or five absolutely nonsensical
noises.
But yeah, exactly.
we found this when we were doing Framley, when we were doing the Framley Examiner, that we found that once you had this bucket, this form, that people knew... What is it saying to people? You know what to expect next.
Yeah.
You know how a quiz show works. You know how the news works. You know your brain is probably two or three beats ahead of where we're going with this. And you know the next three things they're going to say. Mm. When they don't say those things, you can put anything in there as long as the rhythm is maintained. And we found when we were doing Framley, we could do the broad shape of a news story or something that was recognisably about local news, like a bus lane or something. Mm. But the real joy came when you had the look of an advert or a classified advert.
Yeah.
And you could just put gibberish in. Sometimes we would just write down what we were saying in the room and then put it in the right, put the carriage returns in the right place. And people would say, oh, this is really funny. It's not funny. It's just that it's the shape of an advert with literal nonsense in it.
I don't think you did that. I think you often put excellent jokes as on the hour.
There would be jokes in there.
Yeah.
But there would also be sometimes we would put gibberish in, and sometimes people would go, this is delightfully silly. And you're only laughing because you know that's not meant to be there.
Yeah.
It's in the wrong place. You're enjoying the fact that you've recognised the shape of something. And you've also recognised that this is an imposter. It's a boojum.
There's that one where he does, he's been out on the street and the broadcast has gone wrong, which is technically brilliantly well handled. He then has to get a taxi back to Broadcasting House, and he's obviously got a Nagra around his neck and a mic in his hand. Mm. And he walks into Broadcasting House and actually starts upsetting security on the front door, who are going, can I see your pass, please? And he says, I'm bursting with news, you've got to let me through.
If you stop me, I'll explode. And he also starts with just a little word pair. He starts that bit by saying, I am precisely bang outside Broadcasting House. Precisely bang. What? But yeah, then you... That's another of those where you think, oh, is this Steve Coogan doing his security guard? But no. You are trying to get into Broadcasting House without showing your pass.
Yeah, and he ends up in the fire safety officer's office, doesn't he?
Yeah.
Trying to get him to...
This has got to be an emergency newsroom or something.
Yeah.
And that guy is not playing. And by the end of it, you... Yeah.
Yeah, he's ready to bin him, isn't he?
Yeah, that's right. He's really squaring his shoulders. Going back to what you were saying about the... Because they've got Coogan and Rebecca and the others, they're extremely good at doing naturalist performances and sounding like real people. But then when he's talking to a real person, there's a level above where you go, oh no, that is... somehow that's uncounterfeitable, that... that baffled person in the street voice.
The law.
People go on about tightening up the law, don't they?
Yes.
What are your feelings about that particular idea?
Well, I agree thoroughly with it.
A couple of turns or a bit more, do you say?
Well, you say a couple, I say about six.
What effect do you think those six turns would have?
I would hope that it would bring them back to their senses.
Make its presence felt in their brain sack.
That you think that can't be. It's not just a question of whether he could do the accent or not, because of course he could do the accent. It's although, side note, I love that at this age, Rebecca Front can do American, but the rest of them, even Steve Coogan, they have long segments in America, and it's all a bit wobbly, just as me and my cast, but particularly me, are doing sketches on Radio 4 to this day. So I was quite pleased that, oh, good, even Steve Coogan went a bit... I mean, these days, of course, he can do it flawlessly, but those days, yeah.
Her Barbara Wintergreen is magnificent.
That's just perfect, yeah.
It's like when someone first can do a Prime Minister in an impression show, yeah. And then everyone copies it afterwards. She got how an American presenter talks.
Yeah.
And now, if you do an American presenter... Man or woman, you are copying.
You are partly doing Rebecca Front doing one. Mm. Yeah, absolutely.
Mother Nature is a woman.
It's an issue that's divided the USA. Women's League protester Donna Doubtfire dubs Morgan's legislation geographic gynofascism.
It's geographic gynofascism.
They constantly kept finding the key to cabinets of jokes that we hadn't
or
got
parodying
before.
Things that it just hadn't occurred to, or even specific people in particular tones of voice that it just hadn't occurred to you to do. The guy who presents feedback. And it's not a precise parody of him, but it's also not imprecise. It's not just some guy. It is that kind of a voice.
One of the things that really struck me, which I don't think had occurred to me before, was the number of animals that are in it. And I thought, actually, that does make sense because Chris studied zoology at university. So, and there's so many stories that are in one way or another hung on an animal. There's the thing about the blue bottle... terrorising the village of Dedham, and there's that entire
and
thing
then they
about
describe they have that intense description of a blue bottle in a way that which I suddenly realised the second time, oh, this is probably a parody of how they were talking about missiles at the time. Would that have been the first of our war? Would it have been, because I remember Scud and
fetishizing
Patriot
the
Patriot missile is an X and a Y and it's got a, so describing the, you know, the blue bottle having six party coloured legs and so animals are funny.
Yeah, everyone likes animals.
Yeah,
they?
I've actually had so when I'm putting together souvenir program, so we just record a great big load of sketches and then we allot them into episodes afterwards, and we do it with post-its or little cards, move them around, and there's all these things we don't want to clash. We don't want too many gang shows or too many two-handers in, or at least to follow one another. And we don't want, you know, any particular cast member to not be in an episode, that kind of thing. But then we've got more and more, and we've had to add the category animal whimsy now. Because I do so many animal sketches, with even when I know that I shouldn't.
You're addicted.
So now I try to keep it down to, you know, two animal sketches at most, or two sketches referencing animals at most in per episode.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
¶¶
today's fronty prongs.
The headlines.
Rocket curtsied before blowing me up, claims General. Embarrassed dog found sniffing wreck of Titanic. And man with glass face, too disgusting for trial, rules judge.
On the hour.
And there's a thing that I noticed again, listening to loads of this back to back. There's a joke that they do again and again and again that is never not funny, which is something slipping or disappearing that can't slip or disappear. Like Lancaster. Yeah. Ireland bursts, the Circle Line station slip round, someone loses a mouth.
And just time to let you know that there's a build-up of heavy traffic on the M4 westbound at Junction 12 as the hangar gyratory system is being towed to Malmesbury this afternoon.
Yes.
Which is just a joke that we love as well. But
and then you've got, yeah, and then later on you've got, in Father Ted, they're taking out the roads for the winter in Craggy Island. So it's...
I think we might have actually stolen the road slipping round without realising it for Framley. One of those unconscious places. A village gets cut off and is starving to death because its junction's gone missing. Oh. And I looked at that and went, oh, yeah, I think it may be one of those things that just went in.
Yeah.
Hey, here's a professional question. Have you ever found that you have accidentally plagiarised an idea?
Yes.
Yeah.
We've all got one of these stories, haven't we? People think plagiarism is something that's always premeditated, and usually it's just in the mulch in your head.
Well, I think there's three broad categories of plagiarism. There is actual plagiarism, which definitely happens. Secondly, there is just coincidence, and it's astonishing just how specific you can have the same idea with something that for some reason you know that, you know, I've had that with sketches where something will come out after I've written a sketch, but before, oh, I think I did one about Thomas the Tank Engine wondering, you know, what's the works behind the face? How much of that is engine and how much of it is guts? And and how does driving it work? So I got Simon Caine as Thomas cheerily saying, yes, pop aboard, just put your hands into my brains and massage the lobe until I know where to go. And so we'd written and I think recorded that, certainly written it, and then Charlie Brooker tweeted sort of the same observation about, it's the sort of thing that is going to come up.
It would be plagiarism if such a thing as Thomas the Tank Engine didn't exist.
Right.
I always find that usually when people say, oh, that's plagiarism, it's an observation about something in culture that we all share, that we all have watched the same television programmes. And if you've got a comic brain, you will have run it past probably the same process in order to make a witty observation on the sofa.
But that's maybe not even a good example of just how something that seems, well, that must be plagiarism because two people couldn't possibly have come up with that thing. It's not an observation on a thing. It's just a weird collision of ideas. But it does happen.
Yeah.
And it happens more than people think, particularly, and I've done this myself, if they think they're on the wrong end of the plagiarism. I did a silly joke about somebody doing their PhD on a concordance for all of the works of the Bronte sisters, so that you could look up any reference from any of the Bronte's books and see which of her sisters had used it in other contexts. And then the examiner saying, did you do this just so you can call it a Brontosaurus? yes I did. And then within the year, which is why I realise it can't be a plagiarism, somebody published a Brontosaurus, you know, pretty much literally that. Yeah. And I certainly looked, and it came out in the Christmas book market, and I certainly sort of looked at that and thought, oh, right, you got that out pretty quickly. And then realised, yeah, you got it out so quickly that you must have already had the idea. Yeah. It's just a pun waiting to happen, and it happened to two people at the same time. But the third type of plagiarism, which is the one you asked me about, and definitely also happens, is the accidental one, where you think it's you, but then you know, with a horrible sinking feeling, you rewatch Absolutely or something and go, oh, no, that's definitely where I got it. There's a bit in Cabin Pressure, my sitcom about pilots. I used to do cold opens, little usually one of the pilots talking on the PA, and I did one of the captain saying, just to reassure you, there's absolutely nothing to worry about. Stop. And then coming back. And then I went a different way from that. But it's a Python joke. It's just, I mean, it's literally, they have a little bit of preface to it of, you know, isn't it boring up here? Oh, I know what will liven things up. And then they do that, and then they enjoy the reaction of their passengers. But it is the same joke, and I watched all of Python when I was a kid several times, so there's no way I haven't heard it. Yeah, it was so far down in the mulch that when it occurred to me, I thought it had occurred to me as my idea.
I think you forget as well how much growing up, if you're a comedy fan, you learn not only about comedy, but about what happens on the flight deck of a plane from watching comedy shows. I think I knew about planes because of Airplane and Python sketches. So when my brain goes, what happens on the flight deck of a plane? They do that thing where you push the intercom and say, there's nothing to worry about. Not realising that wasn't from a documentary on flying, it was from Python.
Yeah.
You absorb this stuff. There's a great story that Graham Linehan tells about the pilot of Father Ted, which was a 10-minute little scene taster they made for Channel L4, and it's Father Jack has died in bed, and Ted's busying himself around the bed opening the curtains. And it's very, very funny, and Dermot Morgan sells it brilliantly, and they got the series off it. And years later, he and Arthur noticed it's Fawlty Towers. It's what?
It's even blocked
the same way as John Cleese fiddling with the curtains and talking to a dead person. Yeah. He said the reason it worked, and they went, that'll be a good sitcom, is it was already a good sitcom. It was Fawlty Towers. He said, it's not joke for joke, but he said, I realised that we'd got the blocking and the busying yourself and being nervous from something else we'd watched growing up, and when someone said to us, how do you make a sitcom?
Yeah.
And you go, well, you have that man fiddling with the curtains.
Yeah, that's absolutely. And that's reminded me of the fourth type of plagiarism, which is accidental because you meant it as a reference. You meant it as a deliberate hat tip, and people think that you're... which I sort of know well enough. I know how not to do that now, but I did that. Again, in Cabin Pressure, I had Carolyn, the sort of irascible figure, answering a phone with, what fresh hell is this? Which was something that Dorothy Parker used to answer the phone with. And I meant it absolutely as Carolyn likes Dorothy Parker and she is quoting her, but I would never do that now because it's too obscure a quote, so it simply looks like I'm trying to get the credit for Dorothy Parker's line. So you have to absolutely signal that you are, you know, these days I wouldn't do that without saying, yeah, without mentioning her name.
Throw Dorothy Parker into the back end of it to make sure it makes sense.
Yes, although then of course it wouldn't work and so you wouldn't do it. So write your own jokes, Finnamore, you lazy bastard.
But you're allowed to because you've written too many. And now Dorothy Parker is now your secret backroom boy.
How will you be celebrating your millionth gag when you write it?
The thing is, I don't feel prolific because...
Don't you?
I know, I don't.
Seriously?
I mean, you're right. I mean, I obviously am in that just how much I've written, but I find writing so difficult and so the writing process, whatever it is I'm writing, but particularly narrative, anything with sketches are bad enough, but anything with a narrative is so painful and takes me so long that my feeling, all of my feeling of myself about a writer is how lazy I am and how I give up too easily and how I got almost nothing done today or this week or this month or maybe even this year, clap, clap, clap. And I just, and then because it's my only job and I've been doing it for a while now, I have written quite a lot of stuff, but I don't feel like that guy. And I know writers who are. I know, I always think of you two as extremely prolific, and also Andy and Kevin, and, you know, other guys who I just always admire the sort of...
What you're talking about there is basically a mixture of drive and guilt and self-hatred.
Yes.
That sounds like a pretty good mix.
I wouldn't say that I am a tortured... I don't want you to think I'm a tortured artist who, you know, I'm not flaying myself all the time. It's just that I find writing difficult, and so I have a moderate and, I believe, earned level of guilt at the end of the day where I go, really? Is that what you've done?
Yeah, you've earned some guilt today. Well done. Do you not write sort of 10 till 5 or whatever then? Do you sort of write as and when?
As I say, I'm trying to be better at it, but I'm still not good at it. And I love the freedom of being self-employed and making my own hours and having a line if I want one and working through the night if I want to, although more usually because I have to, because deadlines.
Yeah.
But... I've been doing this for long enough now that I should have got over the joy of being my own boss and just, worked out a system that works and probably do fewer hours, but more rigidly and more productively, but I can't do it.
I think that, this seems fairly normal. I mean, most writers I know spend their entire life looking at other writers going, they've got it right.
Yeah.
And it's a version of that thing you used to do at school where I'd go, I can start my book project if I've got the right pen.
Yeah.
And the right pen, I'll go and buy a new book and I'll write on the front, special book project.
Yeah.
I don't think even Stephen King doesn't do that.
Yeah, absolutely. And you're jealous of other people's methods as well. Like, oh, that's how they use their notebook, or that's how you're doing your post-its. In the office we're in, there are post-its on the wall, and I'm going, oh, so that's how they're right. He's got, they've split the second act into two. I see.
Oh, and someone's got the secret. The idea is that someone...
And there's a stupid part of me that's going, oh, this is how a real writer does it. Oh, if I was a proper writer, I'd do it like that. And
think,
I'm
definitely frauds.
Making it, you know, even if you hate my stuff, even if people hate my stuff, I'm definitely, you know, this is my only job. So I'm at the very base level. I can put on my passport writer. That is comedy writer, indeed. That is what I do. Yeah. But I still... It's not imposter syndrome exactly, because I don't feel an imposter. I feel like I like my stuff. I don't feel like a fraud. I don't feel like I've... You know, everyone's writing great stuff and I'm writing this shit and somehow I'm getting away with it. I don't feel that. But then the imposter thing sneaks out in little, you know, as you say, looking at another writer's notebook and going, oh, that looks proper. And I know people do that. I work a lot in notebooks, and I know people do that with mine because I have quite small handwriting and I fill my pages and I do...
You're human skin, isn't it?
Spider that, drafts about, and so on. Skin. And so I think people look at that and go, oh, that's... And I'm just looking at it going, what? That's... I mean, what do you mean? I've done a doodle of the Pope on a mantelope in the corner there. What do you think that is? I'm a child.
I went round the British Library's got an exhibition at the moment of Harry Potter, and I think it's just closed, and it was basically Joe Rowling's notebooks and things, and I went round it exactly in that way. I went, oh, right, so it's that sort of a pen.
Yeah,
and I
yeah.
genuinely thought if I had that sort of pen, I'd have sold 4,000 million books. Because it's the infantile brain that goes, I'm doing this wrong. Because I suppose...
Well, then that cargo cult thing of, okay, so if I can make a notebook that looks like that, then maybe...
And sit in that cafe in Edinburgh. Yeah. Then my... And it's just this... I suppose it's because no one tells you how to do it.
Yeah.
Really. And when they do, you go, oh, God, I didn't do it that way. And even if you're trying to copy someone's working methods, you're constantly guilty that you're doing it wrong.
And then, yeah, I know in a more positive way, then once you've done it for a bit, I can take comfort in doing things the same way. So I have as I say, use notebooks, and I have a different notebook for every series or every, you know, project. And so I can look at the ones I've filled, or the ones that, at least if not filled, you know, produced the last series, and go, okay, well, that's what it looks like when it's finished, and this is what it looks like now, and it's not that different. So once it's more full, that will probably be another series of the sketch show.
This is a version of something which we've said a lot. I mean, I know Jason enjoys writing more than I do, but I say I don't really like writing. I like having written.
Yeah, absolutely.
And there's nothing I like more than looking through a notebook that's already full.
Yeah, yeah.
And, oh, did that.
Yeah.
I'll have to do that again.
Oh, I know. It's more so, I would say, than listening to odd stuff, because then you always, perfectionist part of you, always, there's always something to spot. Always go, oh, I do that differently. But when you look through an old notebook or read an old draft, it's not the finished draft, you can allow yourself to believe that, oh, all of those, you know, those things would have, well, this is the majestic work in progress, this
platonic
ideal,
you know,
I'm sure it was perfect when I finished it.
I remember David Mitchell saying that, so that every point from the point of someone saying, will you do this program, is a massive compromise. And the best moment of any show is when someone says, would you like to do this show? And you go, it's going to be amazing.
Yes, yeah.
And at the moment you put the first word down and it's not as good as you were hoping, every bit from that point is a slow descent into compromise. And actually, the joy of a notebook is that every one of those ideas could be the best thing you ever written.
Yeah, I can make that first moment last longer. I enjoy the first week of a new project because there's no pressure. No one's expecting to see a draft yet, and it can be anything. And so I can write any silly old idea down and see where it goes. And there's that sense of, oh, this is, yeah, it's all of the fun and no guilt yet. There's no debt that you have to do this. This is an idea I'm working on, but, you know, this is one way it could go, as long as it's funny. But once I get bored of it, I can move on to something else, and that's fine. That's what I should be doing. I should be exploring different paths before I pick the one. So I enjoy that bit. And then I enjoy the last week of a project where you've got the antepenultimate draft and you're pretty pleased with it, and you're just going through and thinking, oh, yeah, no, that, now I can make that tie up with that, or I could change that name to something funny, putting the extra jokes in. That's fun. And then there's the 97% in the middle. It is hard. I find it hard at every stage, almost all the time. And then I suppose the other enjoyable bit is every so often something takes flight and starts to make you laugh, and it might be a sketch, a particular sketch idea, which you just you find yourself almost dictating to yourself. I mean, I'll polish it later, but I can get it all down on the page because it's making me laugh. Or even in a narrative thing, and there was a bit in Cabin Pressure where one of the pilots forces the other to tell an anecdote on PA about how he once did something ridiculous, you know, how he outwitted a polar bear with an egg whisk, that sort of thing, as a punishment for, you know, the battle they're having.
Animals,
absolutely. And he's also making him do it in a French accent because he's introduced, he said, our captain will be Captain Ducreuf, and so...
Ladies and gentlemen, First Officer Richardson again. As you know, here at Unbeaten Track, it's our pleasure to provide you with a short talk or anecdote.
Douglas, no!
One of the crew with particular knowledge of the region. Ladies and gentlemen, your captain.
Hello. Well, I don't like to talk about this.
And that bit, I remember walking down. I do a lot of writing while I'm walking, and then either note it down when I get back or just dictate it into my phone these days. And I can remember the stretch of the canal I was walking down, and I'm dictating it in my silly French accent into my phone, and it's just coming, and it just kind of came all in one piece, and wasn't that much changed even by all the polishes and edits. And that was fun, and that was one tiny little moment in that episode, most of which was because it's plotting. We've been talking about sketches, but you know, in episodes, in anything with a narrative, the plotting is that's the killer.
And
that's
if you
the
get
one
it wrong,
no
yeah,
fun.
Yeah. If you get it wrong,
yeah,
everyone forgets all the jokes you've made.
Yeah, absolutely.
Even if the point is that the plot was supposed to be silly.
Yeah.
People go, well, that wouldn't happen. It's just jokes.
That's the genius of Airplane, that they bought a plot that worked. Yeah. They bought a B-movie and they made it not shot for shot, but plot point for plot point. So actually, the story they tell, it's not an interesting story, but it's a perfectly good dramatic story. And then they can be, back to your point about the bucket, you know, to contain all the silliness. Because they are telling a disaster movie with the same characters and the same plot points as the original disaster movie, they can just be as stupid as they like with everything else.
We found this, we did Touch of Cloth with Charlie Brooker, and the idea was literally, I mean, Charlie's good at taking ideas that have been done before and doing them again. When he pitched Black Mirror, he said, I want to do Twilight Zone again. Same. Right. What they were frightened of in the 50s, I'll find what they're frightened of now. It's a really good way of saying, okay, let's try and do an idea in a new way. And when he did Touch of Cloth, he said, let's do the Airplane Zucker Brothers model. And to do that, he bought a script that was written by Boris Starling for Messiah, hard-bitten bloody crime series. Mm. And he and Dan Meyer took that script and ripped it apart. It was an unfilmed episode that Boris had written. They took it apart. Then we got called in. We did a few rewrites on one, and then we got called in to do Touch of Cloth 2. Mm. And they said, right, okay, we want to do a gang, something about gangs, like undercover in a gang. And we said, so whose script are you buying? And they went, what? And we said, are you not going to buy another script off Boris? And they went, oh, no, this time around, we don't have one. So we had to write an entire crime drama first and pitch it in and get it accepted. And then take the pee out of our own script, because you need the skeleton there first.
Absolutely.
It's another joyous moment in a plot where you go, oh, that's just that one thing's not working in act one, so I'll just lift that out, and then acts two and three come crumbling down around you.
Yeah. But often in slow motion, you do that. It's Father Ted and his hammer mending the car.
Yeah.
It's there, you go, I'll just get the dent out with the toffee hammer at the first act. Oh, but I mean, I've just had this actually with something else I'm working on. It was a note, and it was a reasonable note. We had a good note session with the producer. So I delivered the script. They'll say, yeah, we want the draft, and then we'll give you some rewrites. And that's part of the original fee. It's not, you've done it wrong. Yeah. It's what's expected. Yeah. We'll have some notes for you. Part of your job is to do those notes. So that happened, and it was a perfectly amicable session in which everyone was decent, and the notes they gave were, I either agreed with or thought, well, fair do. So that's perfectly reasonable. It's your call. So go back and do that. All right, so this thing that the main character does, you feel that makes him too unlikable. I can see that. Fine. So I'll make it a bit, you know, it's still a transgression, but it's not as bad as all that. Well, okay, but now why is she reacting so harshly? Yeah. Now she's unlikable. Ah, okay, so I'll make it that she thinks he's done the bad thing. Well, hang on, if they're in love, why doesn't he just explain? Okay, so I'll make it that he doesn't have time to explain. Okay, well, what's stopping it? Oh, well, maybe the villain. And then you're rewriting the plot. And ended up from that wasn't a micro note, but it wasn't a big thing, and neither the person giving the note nor I thought it was a big thing when we had that meeting. We thought it was a medium thing, and it would take me a day or two, and then I ended up rewriting most of the first act and quite a lot of the second, because everything had a knock-on effect. And then, of course, and this is to be positive about it, perhaps then, rather than the villain being obviously the villain from the start, maybe it's one of those villains where there's a reveal halfway through that he's, or a third of the way through, that he's actually not on the hero side. Oh, well, that's much better. So now I'm rewriting the villain's character to make him duplicitous, and that's made the script better. Don't pull on those threads unless you have time.
It's an amazing process. We found that we were helping Paul King put the Paddington movies together. It's very often you'd be called in for sort of reshoots and things after most of the film had been shot, and you're pulling on threads with something that's already been made.
Yeah.
And you've got to build it out of the shots you've got. And sometimes the rewriting process with plot is like doing a Lego set where you've only got the bricks you were given.
Yeah, yeah.
But and that is when you start to really appreciate the technical craft of building a plot, which is sometimes you're making it from the bits it's a limited set.
Yeah,
and
sometimes a limited set can be helpful because you don't have all the bricks in the world to build something to build whatever you like from. No, you've got to build. Okay, so in the Lego analogy, even if you've just got the pirate ship Lego set, and then nothing's been built yet, but you've only got pirate ship bits. Now you don't want to build the pirate ship on the box because that's been done. You've got to want to build something fun with this, so you're going to build a castle, or it's more like you start with that big piece that forms the stern and go, okay, well it's not a stern, but I've got to use it somewhere, so what is it, what might that be? And and I've got a sail as well, so I've got a big piece of cloth and I've got this funny and then you think of something that links those
limitations,
and you get an idea
really
you never have otherwise.
Sometimes it's just combining stuff, and again, because your brain works that way, that's why accidental plagiarism sometimes happens. You're reaching for things that are in the box already, and sometimes they are familiar tropes and familiar tricks and things like that, and the delight is the recombination rather than everything being 100% a pirate ship.
There was, and in sitcom as well, when you're actually defining your characters and they're making it, it's very tempting when you're devising the setup to start with to try and leave everything open so that you've got plenty of wiggle room later. So if I want him to have a sister later, he can have one, but if I need him to be any child, that's fine. Actually, I find these days, the more you specify the characters, not only do they become more real, but also, so in Cabin Pressure, for the first series, I didn't define the plane very much. For exactly that reason, I wanted it to be a sort of, it's radio, so it can be an elastic plane. We don't have to think too hard about, so in the first series, there's a bit where it does a transatlantic flight, no problem, with clearly quite a lot of passengers, and there's another bit where it seems to be almost a, four-seater, and that was all fine. It's just, it's the plane, we don't really, and then I decided to, when we got the second series, I decided to define it, and I sort of just worked out what kind of plane it would have to be for the operation they were running, and I worked out, where, how many engines it had, and where they were, and how many seats they were, and the layout of the, and that was limiting, but it made the plots after that so much better. And there was one in particular that came out after me wanting to do, actually it's back to the Polar Bears one, I had an idea for a plot where they would take some people, they would stand in for a company that wanted to go polar bear spotting, which is the thing you can do in Canada where you all get in a light aircraft and, try and spot polar bears. And I wanted our guys to do it, but the plane that I had invented couldn't possibly do that. It's a jet plane, it's too big, it's too noisy, it wouldn't go that low. But then, of course, that becomes a plot because one of my pilots is gung-ho and loves flying and would say, yeah, but if we, left out half the fuel and if we... and I also asked my aviation consultant about it, who's my father, who was a pilot. So, in fact, in my case, not everything I know about planes is from Monty Python. And he got into, he's sort of interested in the problem and went, if you're in the Arctic, then there's no trees, so you can fly low. And it's like, this is what Douglas would say. And then Martin, of course, would be aghast at that. And so suddenly you've got a plot.
Yeah. It's one of the things that you find when you're writing to the page and you think, I'll leave this all open. I won't decide who this person is. And at some point, you're going to have to look an actor in the eyes and say, they'll say, so is he nervous? Totally. Oh, I didn't decide.
Yeah.
So at some point, someone's going to ask you, who is this person? Mm-hmm. And it's really useful for you to have decided that, because otherwise the costume department go, anorak, cardigan?
Yeah.
You want to know what.
And you end up
wear.
With a black, because they'll have, there'll be a certain type of person. There'll be a, there'll be a really broad category. But if you leave it, stay at home dad or the, uptight pilot or whatever, but that's the sort of the fusser. Well, there's so many different ways to be a finicky fusser in sitcom. Yes, that's a standard sitcom trope. And yes, by God knows, you can leave it at that and someone will come along and do a perfectly decent job of being a finicky fusser, but it's not a real person and therefore it's not funny and it's not
specificity
going to,
is where the joke comes from. Remember, Victoria Wood always said that specific biscuits, not a biscuit.
Yeah,
and again, taking us back to,
and she was great also, not just about saying a specific biscuit, but also about dropping in something from a character's not backstory but just hinterland that she made it. I'm thinking of that woman in the hikers she meets in the hiking episode of Mensana, which is one of my favourite bits. The wild, come on, daddy, and the wild blue Honda, and so on. And there's again, I don't want to paraphrase it and mess it up, but there's just a thing about, he can't do that, not with his. No, see, that's going to mess it up. Saying not with his bladder is the shape of a joke that a bad Victoria Wood impressionist does, especially if he's trying to do it on the hoof. But what she actually does is so much more real, and is just a real person who we happen to have met, not just a funny northern woman in a sketch.
What a lovely weekend you're going to have.
What did you call it?
Backpacking.
Backpacking.
Ooh, what a phrase or saying that is. But I'd walk for miles, but we're tied to the Honda with Daddy's groin.
His tea drinking's pretty much censored since his operation. Excess liquid puts too much pressure on his tubular grommets, apparently. Are you nearly done, Dad?
I'm just adjacent to finishing, then.
But you glimpse a world beyond the line. And most people, when they're listening to comedy, are looking for clues. So you're trying to second guess one of the reasons that On the Hour is delightful. You don't know what's going to happen next. The characters are unpredictable, but you know the shape of a news report, so you know roughly where they're going to go. But you listen for clues.
Yeah.
And those hints at a world beyond the line are what you've got in the way that Chris Morris bullies Alan Partridge.
Yeah.
There's a... What's that brilliant line where he does a long characteristic On the Hour line that goes out of control, and at the end of it backs off the mic and goes, "Who in sodomy wrote that?"
Yes.
And you get the feeling that he doesn't like the new intern who's writing his VO script. Yeah. And that specificity, that note of when Alan Partridge says something that tells you what his life is like back in Norfolk, clues, you're seeing within the fractal. You stare into the comedy and you see a truth beyond it. And that's not to do with anything wanky about, oh, comedy is truth. It's just funnier to have authenticity and to have thought about everything, about the engines on the plane.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
Who's in the office with Chris?
Yeah.
Did you notice that Alan Partridge is married in On the Hour? There's a Mrs. Partridge who gets referred to.
Not only married, but widowed, and then reunited because she comes back from the dead. In one episode, one of the awkward throws to Alan is...
Alan Partridge with today's sport. And I understand over the weekend, Alan, your wife died.
Certainly. Straight like a bolt out of the blue, as they say.
And then he does a sort of... It's a funny little sketch. And then, and I was working on the extension and, suddenly a bolt in the blue and certainly miss her. And then a couple of episodes later, Alan, I hear your wife came back from the bed. Yeah, quite unexpected. Is there much of a smell? A bit of a hoy. Hoy is such a perfect word for that. But certainly I do love her. Putrefaction hasn't... Oh, damn it, I can't remember, but...
You know that there's... I've heard one of these tapes, but Chris sometimes used to get Steve Coogan in, get him into character as Alan Partridge and just hit play and record. And Steve would just go off for hours monologuing away to himself as Alan Partridge. And Chris still has these tapes, because Coogan is obviously slightly possessed by Alan Partridge, isn't he? He's someone he's found within one of the darker core of himself, I think.
I love that when someone's got that got someone else inside them.
Yeah.
It's I remember Thorpe from Viz saying that when he writes Mrs. Brady, old lady, I said, how do you write that? Because it's such authentic old ladyism.
Right.
And he said, I just come in and say she's going to the doctors, to Graham, who does Roger Melly, and Graham turns into an old lady. And I write as quickly as I can everything Graham says about going to the doctors. And then he just sort of calms down. The little old lady leaves him. It's like he's got like a spirit guide. He's a little old lady. And it's just verbatim Graham being an old lady. I think we have covered quite successfully all of comedy with special reference to On the Hour.
Good. Well, I'm sorry therefore you have to bring your podcast to a premature end before it's even begun, because we've done it all now. But
I think that's it. That's finished. I hope everyone enjoyed discussing comedy.
Yeah, I could come back and we'll do, tragedy next time.
Or sport?
Sport.
History repeats itself once as tragedy, once as sport. Never as comedy. Thank you very much, John Finnemore.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.